Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening in. I'm hoping that you will find this topic as fascinating as I do by the end of this 30 minutes. Thank you. I haven't heard that noise in years. So we're going to take you through various things. So when we, this topic is very much in the public imagination. There have been plays, there have been countless books written about British Rail privatisation in particular. And the one that this talk is named after is from Private Eye. And it's a compendium of one of their columns I had about taking Thomas the Tank Engine and his various compatriots through the process of the privatisation process that was happening at the time. And that book is now 30 years old as of last April. So, and then on top of that, us nerds love talking about trains. About the 2010s, we all got obsessed with maps for some reason, kind of tube maps, train maps, all this sort of thing. So it's definitely a popular topic. So the aim for today, and then also, when I submitted my talk proposal, this came through, and then my talk got accepted. So I'm now topical. Excellent. I've also had to rejig these slides 3 times because we've had various political updates happening during this, up to the run-up to this event. So I'm going to take you through the entities of British Rail, or what British Rail has become today, and how they all relate with each other. There are some simplifications. That's okay. I've only got 30 minutes. And the idea is that those of you that are not very exposed to this environment already, you should be able to find out how complicated this is. You'll be able to find out some new stuff that's been happening in the last 10 years or so that's quite interesting. And then that will then give you the grounding to understand why split ticketing and works. And also, because it's EMF, I've got a bonus mode for you. So you can now, instead of learning, you will just be depressed about various things that are coming up. And also, there's a bonus thing, because I couldn't put this in, there's a bonus topic that I couldn't include today that I will talk about in the Q&A later. And then, hopefully, we'll get some fare hacks on the way, and this is pretty much how I entered this topic. I was not in the railway until just under a year ago, so a big chunk of why I'm exposed to this is how can I save myself some money. So, let's take you through a little bit of background context. So, the railways started as private entities, and effectively this acknowledgement that this was a public service and needed some form of regulation started in the 1840s. And 1844 is when the concept of a parliamentary train appeared, this idea that you had to provide a service from A to B because it was vital to the running of a country or to an area. And then in 1923, you had sort of this amalgamation because it was all splintered all over the place into those big 4 companies. And typically, if someone's got a model railway set, that's typically what they've been copying their paints and things from. And then you've got some bits here, and there's little bits around here today, so this is just showing that this is how the big floor was split up, and actually it's very close to Network Rail's kind of definitions of regions today. So this is sort of an internal management thing. Moving on to nationalisation, so that was in 1948, and then the first Beeching report, I've just put that in as a, that was sort of an announcement of sort of trying to amalgamate and try and cut certain railways down, and certain various things were shut. The British Rail Corporate Identity Manual, if you don't have one, it's so lovely. It was an innovative thing in interaction design and product design. Generally, this idea that everything needed to be prescribed in uniform across locations, so when people went somewhere, they understood what they were interacting with. And then 1973. Can you possibly imagine what happened in 1973 that everyone kind of seems to know about if they're interested in trains as a topic? So, you can guess. Oh, we're just going to turn it off. Apologies. So, in 1973, you can probably guess. Was it this? No, actually, It was the patent for the British Rail Flying Saucer, was filed in 1973. But also these very lovely Tom Baker of trains were sort of released onto the network. So then we went through the privatisation era, and this sort of happened. This was initially gradual over the 80s. Various bits were sold off. So British Transport Hotels, Sea Link, so the ferry over. British Rail Engineering was split into various entities, reorged a few times. And then we had full privatisation by 1994. And you can see some like nice paraphernalia from that era here. First hack, SailRail still exists. And because it was privatised relatively early on, you can basically get across the country for a fraction of the normal price as long as you're taking a ferry over to Ireland. So this is me going to Reading, going to London from Reading, and it was about £55 at the time, in 2019. The SailRail, which was a few months after, which took me from Reading to Dublin, was £46.50. So these things still exist. And also, if you buy it on the Irish side, you get this cool paper certificate. So now I have to go into detail on 1990 to 1994. A piece of EU legislation came out at the time that stated that the management of railway operation infrastructure, so that's all the stuff around the train, needed to be separated from the running of train services themselves. So this was sort of pushed through at the time. And various countries did it at different rates. France also did it, but they did it a bit slower. So did Sweden, so on and so forth. And however, we had a bit of political chaos going on at about the time. There was an unexpected election win by the Conservative government. We had a prime minister that wasn't expected to be prime minister. We had a lot of infighting and faction fighting result, which I'm sure you're familiar with if you've been exposed for the last 10 years in the UK now. And a bunch of lobbying from the Adam Smith Institute. And this led to the privatisation of British Rail. And that was the Railways Act 1993. Now, the Adam Smith Institute is interesting because in 2022, they wrote a paper to privatise the moon. So they are very much on the wacky end of lobbying. So instead of something relatively straightforward where we had track, infrastructure, all that useful stuff being looked after by an organisation, and then we had services separately, and then the idea that private services could take over, important, Eurostar was being built, we instead got chaos. And it's difficult to sort of explain all these things. That said, thanks to 15 rebellious MPs, we actually kept national rail cards as part of that process. We would have lost them otherwise. And that's my second hack for now, which is region-specific rail cards are a thing. You might have to be a resident of an area to qualify, and sometimes you don't. They are often cheaper than normal national rail cards, and they often save you money, so it's worth looking into whether one applies for you. So, let me take you through the basics of how a rail franchise works. So, I've been talking about infrastructure versus a train service, and you can sort of divide into various different chunks. I'm going to focus on this concept of a route, which is this concept of allowing passengers to get from A to B. And this idea of the government saying, well, we know this is important, so we will franchise it. So there's this franchise concept, and some of these are available publicly with redacted details, and some of them are not. And it's an agreement between the government and a train operating company called a TOC. I'm going to keep using TOC after this point, to then provide this service. However, lots and lots of caveats. Lots of caveats here. So, first of all, you're not allowed to own your trains. You have to rent them from this concept called a RUSCO. And there's various things that are set up with that. And a lot of the problems you might have had with getting, you know, with your train being too long, too short, whatever, are because getting physically moving trains around is hard work, but also the paperwork around that is much harder than it should be. Franchise also includes concept of track maintenance. So you pay fees to whoever is looking after the track, the infrastructure, the bridges around it, so on and so forth. It also enforces a bunch of rules on how you can sell tickets, what tickets are being sold, and what routes you're allowed to sell tickets for. And then on top of that, a franchise also specifies that a train operating company, a TOC, can run stations, but these stations are owned by Network Rail. And then there's a bunch of other rules, like things like there's a whole load of staff involved in this that need pay and pensions and, you know, that thing that they don't think about with these sorts of agreements that are also specified as part of the franchise agreement. So that is the concept of a franchise. And to link you up with some everyday logos, these are the current entities involved with current private franchises at the moment. You might recognize a bunch of bus companies there. I'll come back to that. And then these are the three main Roscoes. There are a bunch of mini Roscoes on top, but these are about 80% of the rolling stock in the UK. So coming back to the bus companies, we've got Stagecoach up here, but then also these are logos that we might have seen about, but actually they've now lost franchises since. So I've just put them up here so people can reminisce about how wonderful it is to be on a Virgin train, I think. The bus thing. So because the entities themselves were mainly bus companies, because buses were privatized about a decade and a bit earlier, they all jumped in going, yeah, we can run a railway. But one of the things that came out of that was actually, one of the things that came out of that was positive was this concept of plus bus, which you can add onto tickets, and it's often cheaper than buying bus fare if you're doing multimodal. So it's useful to know if you're doing a more complicated trip. That is the concept of a franchise. Is it simple? Sadly not. I've missed a couple of things. I'm going to go through those. But the other idea is that a franchise itself is effectively the government has an agreement with the money, it's with the TOC on the fare that is coming through. So that means that the DfT gets the money from the fares and they get a certain amount. But they subsidize it to a certain extent. So what happens is by about year three of the franchise or year four of the franchise, the TOC doesn't have any profit left because they're giving all their fare revenue to the government and there's nothing left to be able to run. And that's one of the big reasons why ticket prices have been driving upwards. So more exceptions. Track is mainly Network Rail, but also not. HS1 and HS2 are separate private entities. You can find them on Companies House. But they then contract out to other entities like Network Rail to do work, who run that under sister companies. And then there's also TfL Rail, and there's also Mersey Rail in there as well. To give you some idea, a TOC themselves managed to forget to pay, or managed to forget that they needed to pay HS1 in their accounts, misdeclared to the government, and somehow managed to mislay £25 million. That is a TOC, this is their job to know how this all works, got it wrong. So, the other one, stations are mainly managed by TOCs, but then also not. There's a lot of big ones that are managed by Network Rail instead. I think this one's from Reading from while it was being redone. And then TOCs are mainly franchises, but also not. There is also this concept of an open access operator. These are purely private entities. They keep all the financial risk, and they pay fees to use a track. But you might notice a lot of these companies are similar. So you might notice Grand Central by Arriva on the other item. So there's a bit of interesting relationships going on there with how the fares are sort of being gradually rising over time. So bringing this all together, you have your TOCs, you have your Network Rail, you have your HS1, your HS2, and a few other organisations in there, and that is what is called the Rail Delivery Group. And the Rail Delivery Group looks after fares, they look after data. I think there was a data talk certainly earlier about this. And then they also do a little bit of lobbying. Bringing the rail delivery together, you might recognise that little tiny logo there. That is National Rail. So you now know the difference between National Rail and Network Rail. However, as a butt. Also, I have an elephant next to a butt. I was quite happy with that. But we've forgotten some people, and it's Londoners. So London transport is devolved to a much more heavy degree. And consequently, they have been able to push through so many changes. So when British Rail privatisation came through at the start, this is what a tube map, which you had in paper at the time, looked like. It was relatively much simpler at that time. Thameslink existed, but it wasn't on the map. There was no concept of contactless or Oyster fares, and the entirety of South East London didn't really exist. And then also Crosswell and Overground, and also various other things. So 2024, a lot more things have been pushed through, and a lot of this has been pushing through via localised policies and introductions of things like the Oyster card that have been pushing things through. So, what happened after 1993? Mr. Blobby got on a train. So that's the recap of your franchise here. Now, the first thing to go was rail tracks. So Network Rail didn't exist initially at privatisation. And it was put into this organisation called Railtrack. And what happened here is that it was organised and managed in such a way that it was basically impossible to do good work. It was very much about... There was lots of managers involved that were bedding for work in such a way that it was not optimised for safety. It was not an engineering-driven organisation. And there was a bunch of reviews that happened consequently after a bunch of safety incidents that happened here. So these are real incidents that occurred. And that then led to Railtrack being renationalised in 2002. And then that then converted into Network Rail we know today. 2018 onwards, many talks have now been renationalised. You can normally find this out by looking for the phrase operator of last resort. So this is all, if you can go find the organisation on Companies House, you can find, oh, okay, that's fine, it's been renationalised. But it now means 7 out of the current 17 franchises are run by the government. And this is from the start of COVID. But the idea here is that the Roscoe started losing money at this point, so the government had to intervene and subsidise some of their stuff as well. So they're pouring money into all these different organisations to get them to talk to each other and flow together, but they don't have much control. It's all been set up in a way that people can't really kind of run things very easily and simply. So we've broadly gone from this, where the Department of Transport had tried to privatise the whole thing, to this today. So all my blue elements here are renationalised, and the Rail Delivery Group is partially renationalised because of the membership of it. That means, as of today, 64% of the routes that are covered are now renationalised. About 40% of the staff are renationalised. There's quite a bit here. However, there's even more. How many of you have done a picture where you've been stuck on a train, unable to work, and you take a picture to prove to your boss that you can't work in that state? I've got quite a few of these. So the other thing that I really love that I've been sort of picking up on is this devolution of transport. Now, a transport authority. So there was some mayoral elections recently. I don't know if anyone was in an area that was affected by, but what that means at these new authorities, and it's called either deeper devolution or trailblazer agreements, but they have devolved bus franchising and rail policy out to the local areas. But these are collections of local authorities, and they all have to vote into this concept. So a lot of infighting has been happening, which is why not every area has been covered by this point. So to bring that together, if you live in Wales, woohoo, you're already fine. If you live in Scotland, again, I'm pretty sure the consulate will be able to tell you about all about that. And then in England, 50% of the current population is now covered by a new style of mayor. That allows you to, that means that they have increased authority on spending, and this has only just started. So, Last one, I'm sure the consulate will tell you, currently ScotRail are trialling no off-peak fares at the moment. So please go to Scotland if you can. And then some links here about where this has all come through and whether you have a mayor or not. Split ticketing. Right. You've got the primer now. I can now take you through why split ticketing works and a few edge cases that are less well known. So, if you've not done one before, split ticketing is where you buy multiple tickets instead of one and it happens to save you money. I'm going to extend that definition slightly and say it's a compliant ticket or tickets for your journey that cost less than the expected mainstream fare. And we talked about the TOCs and our open access operators. They all run on routes, this notional idea that passengers need to get from A to B. But that's sort of, it's more of an abstraction above, which means you have situations where multiple TOCs operate on the same routes in certain situations, so or in the same A to P because it overlaps between the two. And that's normally where you can optimize and split your ticket. So, first case, classic split ticketing. These fares are valid as of last week. They might stop working. We'll see how we get on. But Reading to Birmingham New Street, lots more people want to go. That's a much more oversubscribed route, and it's priced by one TOC. However, going on the same stations to do this journey, you can go from Reading to Banbury or Banbury to Birmingham New Street, and those two tickets together are cheaper. And if you notice, the TOC is different in the second section. And typically, you get the best split ticketing situations on cross-country because they basically overlap everyone else's routes. And that's normally where you get the best optimizations. So this is typically because there is demand, but they say it's demand date-based pricing. So because more people need to go from that big long-distance route, they charge a bit more for it. Also, those trains are short and smelly, and I don't like them. But so they've priced it accordingly. But then actually, if you get these local tickets, it works out better. So that is the basic classic split ticketing. And if you go on various train sites, there's lots of tools that automate this for you these days. The next example is a little bit more nuanced, but a lot of ticket types let you start your journey a bit further along your route or stop your journey a bit or stop your journey short. And because the tickets are based on demand, you can be in a situation where you can buy a ticket to a further away place and get off early. So this one still works, but only if you don't contactless. Contactless has fixed this one. But London to Iver is 16.80, but you could just get off early at West Drayton and you save yourself a whole 90p. There's not that many of these left. They've been patching quite a few of these, so I'm hoping with some data hacking we can find some new ones. Third one, saved the most extreme one for last. Off-peak definition hacking. One of the things that is relatively left up to the TOCs is their definition of off-peak and super off-peak. That means that if you are able to be flexible about when you travel or be able to be flexible about which way you go to a place, you can potentially go buy a ticket for a route priced by a TOC that is cheaper than the normal route because they define it as off-peak, but the other train companies still define it as peak. And I've used a relatively extreme example here. If you want to go to London to Newcastle at the moment, there is no off-peak single. You have to pay a whole £200. But if you're willing to go via Sunderland, have a lovely super off-peak single, and then pop yourself on the metro over there, you save yourself about £100. So this is the most interesting one, and this is the one I'm most interested to go play with the data to see, because these are the ones that are basically left. So also, it does mean you have to go via Sunderland, and I think there's a whole thing about Newcastle and Sunderland. I'm an ignorant southerner, so I apologise if I have offended anyone in this audience. So and I put some resources here that you can go and find these. If you don't use anything else from it, fastjp.com, they're running a very nice API that does routing. It's much faster than National Rail's main site. Final one on the hacks. If your journey starts from anywhere in this kind of old area here, what that then lets you do is if you're leaving this area and going via London, off-peak only counts on the way out of London, not on the way in. So you can start your journey as early as you want, as long as you leave London at the off-peak time. And they time this from the terminals. And you can look up when your off-peak codes are on the website there. Right, lots of news has happened in the last month. We have to keep having to rejig these slides. So let's see what this looks like. This man, I won't mention his name, sat in some rain recently and said some things were happening. But it turns out they'd already kind of written this together, written this previously, and they're notionally putting together this concept, the Great British Railways. They're removing Network Rail. They want to keep Roscoe's, and they want to contract train services out similar to the London setup where they contract out services, but it's branded under TfL. It is 116 pages. I don't recommend reading it. It spends most of the time ranting about how much engineers get paid in Network Rail. Labour's announcement, I was read this one too, significantly shorter, but not much detail. Most of you, if you've been following the news, there isn't really much in here apart from what the news has already told you, which is as the contracts expire, they're going to return them back to the government. They don't have any plans on Roscoe's, they don't have any plans on anything else. It's relatively high level. So we're going to have to wait and see. So I'm going to end on a final kind of story on this, because I think this is where I think if you really want to make the rail system better, this is what you need to do. We talked about devolved powers in London earlier and the fact that this devolution is happening in other local areas. Now, this is Worcestershire Parkway, which is where the shuttle bus is going to for most of today. It was opened in the last few years, and it was opened thanks to local authority funding and campaigning. This was local people noticing that two tracks overlapped each other and there was no station, and went, hang on a minute, there's an optimization here and it will actually help us and increase commuting times in the area. So they've done this, and the usage has been going up quite a bit since it's been opened. But what I'm sort of saying here is I wouldn't worry too much about the national elections, although please do vote the sensible option. But if you really want rail improved in your area, check if you have a devolved government or a metro mayor, and please check and please find out who they are, and go and see if there are any local areas in which you can improve the local area where you live. Because instead of snipping things up into arbitrary little pieces, we will hopefully get into a situation where we cut it up based on how it is best for the people that we have. And then this is the summary of our sort of hacks here. And if you notice, most of them will still work post-renationalisation. Because they are all, apart from split ticketing, most of these are actually focused on the local area. So I'm hoping I can still give you some hacks that still work. And that is it for me. I am going to be at the Q&A tent. My challenge for the rail experts among you, how do refunds work with delays? There are lots of murmurs, I know that. But we'll pick up from that. And we can talk a bit about simplifications that I've made in this talk if you're interested. But other than that, thank you for your time. And enjoy.